A good plan today is better than a perfect plan tomorrow.
The Growing the Future podcast is brought to you by Eberhardt Ag Solutions. Join us as we talk to top entrepreneurs in the agricultural space about their methods of obtaining success in their endeavors. And now, your host, Dan Eberhardt.
This is our second session of the Growing Our Future, Growing the Future Room series of talks during Farm Forum. Very excited to be here. Thank you for your attendance. So Terry Eberhardt is definitely, when it comes to the agronomy and the farm side of the businesses, the visionary. And what could I all say about Terry? I could say a lot, but we'll save it for another day. But I will say that I'm extremely proud of him. And the work that he's done and the connections that he's made in the industry has essentially made everything that we do in Eberhardt Ag Solutions possible. Through his work on growing the farm from a 1,500-acre farm when I was growing up and left to do my rock and roll duty to 15,000-acre farm. So he's essentially, since I left the farm at 17, Terry has 10x'd the family farm, along with my father and an incredible team. And he's also been 12, 13 years in the agronomy business. He saw this pattern of top producers being top managers when he was pulling wrenches as his original career. He said there must be something to that management in agronomy. And he hooked up with AgriTrend, was inspired by the network, and built Sure Growth Solutions, which serves a great many customers in the agronomy business today. Terry and his entire family went over to Laos to provide clothing to children that are in orphanages over there, and it was a life-changing experience. Elston and Terry talk about it in the latest podcast. So, but Terry is going to lay down his vision of where things are going. I can't remember the title of his presentation, but I'm sure it'll be self-evident. So Terry's going to lay down some information about precision agriculture and agronomy and where he sees things going. So take it away, Terry. Give a big round of applause for Terry.
Thank you. Thanks for leaving me some time to make my presentation there, Dan, and for the kind words. So somehow, miraculously, the presentation seems to be working now that we've been working on for the last 15 minutes. So excited to be here. I was in Fredericton yesterday. I wasn't sure I was going to make it back, and that would have been a little bit stressful, but I'm really excited to be here, and I think even my mom's here to watch my presentation, which is the first time ever for me, so hopefully I impress my mom, but anyways, hope you enjoy it. So this is, I just always like to start off with a picture of our family. That's something that's pretty important to me, and recently, last year, you know, we didn't normally start off with six kids, we just had three, because that's kind of was pretty cool, but For various different reasons, we brought on another three children into our family, and that's been really cool. We didn't have quite enough excitement with just the three older ones. So I own and operate Eberhardt Farms with the family and my mom and dad, a 15,000-acre grain farm. Started Sure Growth Solutions about 13 years ago now, working with some amazing people like Elston and Rob and Warren and a great group there. And then that kind of led into starting Eberhardt Ag Solutions with Brother Dan and Dad and now the Growing the Future podcast. So that's been a lot of fun too, and just kind of a way for us to kind of give back to the ag community and have some fun and just basically talk to people that we want to talk to. So that's kind of cool. So today really is about just kind of sharing a bit of knowledge and experience, I guess, over the past few years. And luckily, because of the people that I've been involved with, you know, over the past 12 years or so, I've been able to travel to about 10 different countries, learning about agriculture. That's one of my passions, and I really like this quote. So I'm just hoping to share some of that with you guys today and keep you awake before lunch. So what is precision agriculture? I sold this slide from Warren a few years ago, and this is probably the description that I like initially the most, is precision farming is generally defined as doing the right practice at the right location and the right intensity. And I think most people think about precision agriculture just being something that's new, but the reality is it's been around for a long time, and this guy has been a real inspiration to be Les Henry. I'm sure most of you know him. And he was doing some of this type of work way back in the 60s already, which is 50, 60 years ago, which is kind of crazy to think about. And this is some of the stuff that they found when they started. This is when first soil testing chemical labs kind of came into play, and they went out and they started soil testing all over the place and seeing, you know, this great variability in what was out there in the soil. And you can see this was from 1966. A little while ago, a little bit before they had the equipment to know how to manage this. And for less, really, it was about the soil and the topography and the eroded knolls and the lower land and all that stuff, which we all know a fair bit about if you're working with these kind of things. And when they would go out and soil test those areas, they'd see the great difference in nutrients based on what the crop was producing in those different areas. So those eroded knolls were lower amounts of phosphorus because they probably were moving more than what was there, and in the low slopes there was accumulation of certain nutrients, and so huge amount of variability, and it was a long time before we kind of started developing the tools and the equipment to do it with. And so really this is the things that drive most of the variability in precision agriculture and our variable rate programs. And one of the things I did realize in traveling all over the world that we farm in one of the most variable areas on the planet, in the middle of pothole Saskatchewan. And so it's been a pretty fun training ground for precision ag. And there's a lot of different values and benefits and different things that we can think about when we think about precision ag. And it means something different for everybody. Someone's gonna owe me a beer later at Ag Rocks, so that's good. And really, I think for me, the coolest part was being part of the AgriTrend network back in the day. It was an amazing group of people. The best kind of culture and passion for agriculture that I've ever experienced in my career, and met a lot of amazing people. Some of them are in the room here today. And we had a lot of fun doing a lot of crazy things. So some of this stuff is, you know, the knowledge that we kind of learned from working with that team. And I guess in all honesty, everything that we've ever done in our career was not ever done by myself. It was usually done by somebody else, and I just got to talk about it. So that's the fun part. So at the end of the day, when we looked at all the work that we've done in the past, working with that group, and Warren Bills, I think, is in the room, did a lot of the work compiling this together, is looked at 7 years worth of trials and about 500,000 acres, 73 coaches, 150 farms, and on average we've seen about a $35 an acre net return. And this is very similar to what we hear from guys like Mo Russell out of the States. And generally speaking, we've seen about $7 an acre from, you know, improving the management of your input, and about $28 an acre from the grain. And so when we first started working with precision ag, this is kind of what was going on in the industry. I think there was a lot of like my way or the highway mentality of the industry. Every service provider out there kind of had an entrenched idea about how you would go about things, and if you didn't do it that way, you were wrong. And there was a lot of confusion about what was right or wrong, and so some of the questions that we had was, you know, what are the long-term effects on the soil and the field? What are the benefits? What's the ROI? You know, how does this affect efficiencies on the farm? How does this affect environment and sustainability, and what's the value? And I think one thing that we learned that I like to apply or think about lots now is the 80-20 rule. Nothing's perfect. And so usually the 80% of the value is in the first 20%. So we stop trying to get it perfect because we're never gonna get it perfect. Just get it better than you were doing it before. And so this is just a couple of the experiments that we ran in the early days and the questions that we wanted to answer. So you can do variable rate, but if you do it over multiple years, what changes? You know, if you save a bunch in fertilizer, that's great, but in 10 years, are you going to be 50% lower production because you mined the soil, or what's going on? So we took one of the first fields on the farm that we put into variable rate. It was an average. We've tracked all of our yields and those kind of things for quite a while. So this was an average yielding field on the farm. And the first year that we put it into variable rate, we took standard samples and compared what we would have done there. And simply all we did is we compared it to the average. So the first year we saved $18 of fertilizer, and it yielded 54 bushels, and that was the best yielding canola crop on the farm, so maybe that was coincidence. So next year we look at it again. We're still saving a significant amount of fertilizer. Fertilizer prices were really high that year. Getting that benefit from utilizing that extra fertilizer in the low areas. And it was in the top 5%. Same thing with 2010. And then 2011, again, it was the top yield on the farm. We just wanted to prove that we were either maintaining or improving the yield going forward. If we started losing yield, then we know that's not the way we want to go. And so then we looked at the yield actual response in each zone before it went into variable rate as of the red bars. And you can see the lower areas or the poor performing areas, there was a high variance in yield. But as we started implementing some of those precision techniques, we started to improve that. And one of the hugest issues we deal with is soil salinity in Western Canada. And simply by not adding more salt or adding to the problem, we're seeing that we start improving those low areas. So that's ultimate precision outcome, when you can do less and get more. I love those kind of things all day long. And really what we're trying to do is just move the variability of the field into a tighter area. And a lot of times people talk about, well, hey, that poor area you can't really make any better. But if you also have the best areas of the field already yielding 100 bushels, you know, you can probably get more out of that too, but how much more? Because it's already doing really well. So those are some of the things that we're trying to answer. And then we also just wanted to look at, okay, well, that was one example, just what was happening in the field. But let's just compare this to like a flat rate example over the long term as well. So we took this block of land that was around the home base that was always been farmed the same way and generally yielded the same way. And we left one of the fields 25 in just a flat rate standard practice and put the rest into precision. And this is what we started to see. Initially, there was very little yield response. The yield response is in the blue. But we had quite a bit of savings in fertilizer. And this is typically kind of the trend that we see, is there's usually an accumulation of nutrients in certain areas. We get that advantage the first couple years and reallocate it. And the green bar is the net return, taking the yield and the savings of fertilizer. Forward to the next year, that was a little bit higher yield response now, a little less savings in fertilizer, but the net return is higher. And then in the third year, this is a canola year, we actually spent a little bit more on fertilizer by trying to allocate it into those areas that needed more, lower phosphorus and those kind of things. But we got an 8-bushel response, and that was canola, so it looks really good. So on average, the numbers looked really good. I wouldn't say you should expect this in every case, but these were the numbers that we saw over that trial there. And so then we started also looking at what's the benefit of keeping things in balance. And this is what was really hammered into us from guys like Elston and Mike and the guys at AgriTrend. And comparing the ROI pushing single drivers for crop production. And so where this comes from a lot is we experience a lot. Generally, people think about nitrogen when they think about pushing yields, you know. And if they want to grow more grain, it's just turn up the nitrogen tap. And so we decided to set up a trial where we were actually looking at the response of plant growth regulators. So we did variable rate application and then various different nitrogen applications and increasing rates, and quite aggressive rates at the time. And I didn't actually know how this was going to turn out for sure. I thought maybe we're just going to see that the high rates of nitrogen kick butt for yield and return and I'll be out of business doing precision ag. But anyways, this is what we found, and it was really more surprising than I thought. But at the end of the day, the variable rate area yield, this is a wheat crop, yielded 62. The 100 pounds N was very similar. So the variable rate fertility was actually an average of 88 pounds. And when we pushed it to 130 pounds, we saw a reduction in yield. And to 160, we saw even a greater reduction in yield. So definitely going the wrong way with that strategy. And initially you'd say, yeah, but I mean, you probably caused a higher yield potential, and if you applied fungicides, you would have got more. Well, we did. We actually applied fungicide twice because we wanted to remove that from the variable. And even with the plant growth regulators, the higher end rates were better, but still not as good as the variable rate. And this is what we saw in the field during the year. when he went out and looked at the flag leaves, this is after, you know, headline at flag at the time, and it was Prezero on at fusarium timing. And even after the dual applications of fungicide, we've seen very, very high incidence of disease. We're probably pushing that plant out of balance. There was more lodging, even with the plant growth regulators, all that stuff. Harder to combine all those things. And at the end of the day, none of that really matters for the most part, because it comes down to what are you getting in your pocket as a farmer. And the spread between the variable rate application and the highest end rate application was $78 an acre. So, you know, how many of us at times or growers out there are going out there and just cranking up your end tap to try to get more yield, and you're actually shooting yourself in the foot? You're actually reducing your yields, and do you know that? So this is pretty cool. And not only with that, there's the residue issues that come along with that. How does that affect your next year canola crop, and so on and so forth. So for me as an agronomist and a farmer, that stuff's pretty cool. I get pretty excited about those kind of things. And so really, when we look at putting these precision plans together, just an example of the amount of variation that we can see in a field. If you look at the targeted yield response here, nitrogen rates from 58 pounds up to 166, phosphorus anywhere from 16 to, you know, 50 something, I think. Just we normally see a very, very wide range and amount of dollars that we're spending per acre. And we would build out these plans working with the gurus that are way smarter than I am, because I'm just the farmer guy, and help build the right strategies to build the value into the long term. And so we put a lot of time in tracking this stuff over time and seeing what we were doing. And, you know, for me, ultimately, it comes down again to the farmer. What does he get? And when you have your clients sending you pictures like this, saying, hey, this is probably like the best canola I've ever grown. And then when the field, and we've seen this in other examples before too, but what you'll see with doing a good agronomically sound program is you'll see a much more even field. It's ripening all the same. And it's pretty mind-blowing when you have anywhere from 30 to 130 pounds of N on that field, but now it's ripening the same. And some of the first guys we worked with, initially when we got into doing the first years, like doing the farm half and half, they would say, well, the canola on the flat rate seems a lot heavier with the swather, and it's heavier in the low spots, and I'm not sure what it's going to look like. But when the yield came in, the fields that were variable rate and more even, less vegetation, there was more in the grain. And so that was pretty cool too. And then when you look at just from the soil side of things, and I know other precision ag guys and agronomists get excited about this, well, this is just the soil test N in the different zones of the field, and how much extra is in some of those poor areas that we just keep pounding on flat rates of N in the past. And then eventually, as each year goes by, to me, this is kind of one of the benchmarks that we look at. Are we doing it right? Are we setting our yield targets right? Are we putting on the right amount of nitrogen for what we're growing? And if we lower this residual N and even it out, to me, we're on the right track. And in this case, in that one area, that might have been 40 or 50 acres, there was $138 of extra N there. It's quite a bit of money. I'm not charging $138 an acre for the program. That would be good. But so just another example of that. You know, when we get to this kind of thing again, like I said, that gets me as an agronomy geek a little bit excited. Probably doesn't get anybody else excited, but I get excited about those things. And this is just another example of a half section that we had done. And in these areas here, worked out to $10,000 worth of N at like 40 cents at the time. So that was enough in that one field to pay for a precision program for almost 10 years. Just that one thing. So it's pretty crazy. So I get a little bit, you know, excited when people start talking about the value of doing precision ag. So moving on from that, the next thing we started to think about was, what can we do with chemical? And as much as I love to take credit for all the great ideas I think I have, Warren Bills and I, quite a few years ago, went to Precision Ag Conference in the States, and they were talking about doing variable rate defoliation spray in cotton. And Warren said to me, well, why couldn't we do that in canola? for canola fungicide. And I was like, oh, yeah, I think we could. And so this is what we started doing. We started taking high resolution images and not spraying fungicide where the crop is poured. And we've got oodles and oodles of trials that we did with this, but simply one simple way to do precision trials is to do flat rates across the field and see how they respond in each area. It's actually the simplest way to start learning about some of those things. And so that's what we did here in this particular example. And we proved that the red areas were, you know, average 25 bushels an acre, there was zero response. There was zero response where the crop is thin. You know, sclerotinia is a disease that's related to the density of the canopy and how much moisture is in that canopy and the petals getting stuck in the plants, right? And in the green areas and the yellow areas that were higher vegetation, we saw good responses, 6 bushels an acre. And this is a challenge that we see in our area. If we look at the average of the field, we're probably 3 or 4 bushel response, which is kind of a wash. So it's like, do we do it or do we not, or do we go to the lake or whatever? I don't know. But when we started just spraying the best parts of the field, we got that kind of response every year, even on the dryers. It was pretty incredible. And so, you know, and I remember even in the middle of this, we had a meeting with Bayer, and they came out to the farm, and they were kind of like, well, you can't do that because, you know, you got to stick to labels and label rates, and we weren't changing the rate. We were just shutting it off. And then it was a couple of years later after Warren went on to work with Bayer and commercialize this program, which is really awesome, went to a meeting in Banff, and they're like, hey, yeah, remember when you're at your farm? I'm like, yeah, you told me we couldn't do this. And so now a whole bunch of people that are way smarter than me and trials replicated all across the country showed the same kind of thing, right? High vegetation areas are going to have a great response. Low vegetation areas, don't bother. And so that's really cool. And I think at the end of the day, for me, precision ag is really about putting stuff on where you have a higher chance of getting a good return, right? And where that risk is high, maybe you don't bother. So I think, you know, sometimes when we look at adapting new technology, we don't always get it right. And sometimes we make a few mistakes along the way. But at the end of the day, you need data and you need to have somewhere to start. I mean, you don't go to run a 100-meter race and just go to the Olympics and see who runs the fastest across the finish line, right? You got to know what your time is so you know how to get better. And so this is an incredible value and tool once you can start, whether it's managing what's going on in your soil over the long term or weather patterns, all those kind of things. And I think when we can start using this data to make better decisions, that's where it gets really valuable. And things like working with crop intelligence is really awesome. It's been a cool, really cool thing. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. And this is another example of doing like a profit map. So now that we have all the data, we have the yield data, we have the agrimatics scale data coming back into our Trimble system. So we know exactly what the field yielded. We knew what inputs we applied in each zone. We can figure out the cost of bush per bushel per zone and all these things. And we can figure out, hey, what areas of the field are making money or not. And this is one of the simplest, probably, examples of how we've applied precision ag and that kind of information. A field that we were renting in Manitoba. And this was always wet and saline, side hill seeps, and Dad and I were talking about like not renting this field anymore because it was a pain in the butt and we'd get stuck or you'd have to wait to seed it and it was frustrating. And then I got one of the guys that was working with us to look at, well, let's look at the actual profit maps or profitability, not just at 1 year, let's look at multiple years over the long term. And we looked at 5 years, 5 different crops, 5 different seasons, and we figured out on average, we were losing $70 an acre in that red area once we put in all of our rent and our expenses. And we were netting about $50 an acre across the whole field. So what if we just took that poor area out? And so that's what we did. We took it out and we put it into hay. And now they're making like 70, 80 bucks an acre off the hay. And we're just farming the best part. And we're now improved our profitability to $74 an acre. And we're doing less and making more. That's really fun. I'd like to figure out, so get to the point where I could do nothing and make more, but I haven't got to that point yet. But these are the kind of simple things that we can apply this technology on. And this is just an example of one of those areas that we planted down by the town of Langeberg. That was tough to deal with. And now, you know, it's there's a crop growing that's removing some of those salts and stuff there, and it's probably slowly improving the land. Maybe we can bring it back into production. But there is a lot of areas that we're farming that we shouldn't be farming, or we could be doing something better with it that would be better for the environment as well. So I love this quote from Steve Jobs, and I think this is the way we need to look at things. You know, innovation is the ability to see change as an opportunity, not a threat. And really, I think what I'm thinking about now is, you know, where are we going from here? I mean, there's been a lot of evolution from, you know, the stick and the plow to mechanical harvesting. And if you haven't read any of Rob's books, his new book, I just finished reading it the other day. It was really good. And so now we're really talking about sustainable agriculture. And what does that really mean? There's a lot of hype around that. And what does the farm of the future look like? And these are the things that either you could get scared of or excited about, I'm not sure, but usually I'm excited about them, and Octavia here seems pretty excited. She seems excited about the future. I don't know if you are, but... So what do you think your farm's going to look like in the future? And so these are some of the things that I just see happening now and I think are going to have a big influence, and one of them is soil health. We're hearing about this more all the time, and we're just starting to learn about soil health and the bugs and all this stuff, and I love this quote, you know, the nation that destroys its soil destroys itself, and we've been destroying soil all over the world since we started farming. And this is something that we need to do a better job of. Lots to learn here. I think we're going to see.
We hope that you are enjoying this episode of the Growing the Future podcast. Please take the time to visit our sponsor, Eberhardt Ag Solutions, at eberhardtagsolutions.ca. where you can find innovative solutions that transform your farm. And now, back to the show.
A lot of stuff, whether it's the regenerative agriculture, the intercropping, we started doing some intercropping trials this year, and there's lots going on with that, and we're going to see a lot more about biologicals. And biologicals is going to be hitting us like crazy. It's going to be really hard to get through all of the noise there. And one of the questions I keep asking, if you do everything right and you grow great crops and you have a balanced soil and a balanced plant, is the biology already there? And from what I'm seeing from the trials that we've been doing, I think some of it is already there if you're doing a good job. If you're not, you're probably going to see a dramatic response by applying a biological. But maybe that's a sign that you're not doing things the way you should be doing them. Intelligent data. So there's been a lot of hype about big data. But big data is pretty meaningless, I think. It's, you know, we're all sick of that kind of stuff. But data becomes intelligent when you can collect it and then redistribute it in a form that you can understand and make a decision, like a profit map or a long-term trend of soil phosphorus or whatever it may be. And crop intelligence is a great, great example of creating intelligent data. John Deere's had these weather stations forever. We had one before crop intelligence too. I was like, yeah, that's nice, but I didn't really have the time to figure it all out. And then some people got together and, you know, picked Elson's brain behind that big meme he's got there and all that intelligence in there, and they created something very simple. And it's really cool. And I think we're gonna see, whether it's sustainability benchmarks or whatever, there is a lot of value in data once we can figure out how to use it and turn it into intelligent data. The other thing that's happening is going to be happening way faster than we think is autonomy and robots. And DOT, you know, came out a couple years ago, and there's a lot more. I was just at Agritechnica a couple weeks ago, and there is robots and autonomy stuff all over the place. There's stuff that goes up the side of the mountain and mows the lawn and tills your garden, and it's really cool, and it's going to be coming fast, and there's going to be a lot of things that we can do with this. There's a lot of talk about, you know, using AI and spraying just the weeds, and like, well, why are we worried about spraying? Why don't we just leapfrog it so it just pulls it out or kills it with a laser or whatever it is? The other cool thing I saw too is at the Trimble conference a couple years ago at Dimensions, one of their visions is of autonomy is helping farmers execute their everyday tasks by automating processes. So how do you take the knowledge that's in here and apply it to your team through work orders or screens and controllers and system and create a closed loop of sharing that knowledge? Because that's one of the problems that we have today is how do we spread that knowledge across the globe? And that's one of the things that Rob's trying to do with AgVisor Pro, right? How do we extend that knowledge? And so I thought that was really cool, something we need to think about. Machine learning, AI, sensors, and IoT, and all this stuff, like this is crazy. And the advancements that are going on is really, it's exciting and scary at the same time. And so there's companies like Intel and Air example, where they'll fly your field multiple times throughout the year and show you all kinds of different algorithms of what's changing, where you need to scout, and they're creating some really intelligent interfaces. And the more stuff they do with this kind of thing, this the more they learn and the more value they can bring, and is going to be hitting us very quickly. And there's some huge opportunities here. This is just from our field day this last summer. Elston and Kendall from the crop intelligence team. So this is one of the things that really I found a lot of value in the last few years. And, you know, so you put these probes in your field and you can pull up on your phone every day. What did it rain? You know, what's my yield potential now? You know, it's good because when this spring was dry again and cold and most people were pretty dismal. You know, oh, the crop, we're not going to have good crops and the yield's not going to be there, it's dry, but the probes are telling us, hey, you've got higher than average yield potential. And so we've been split applying N now for a couple years and using this technology to help manage risk and get more out of the crop. And so we went and we put our top dress application on and we put extra on because, not just because it told us to, but we knew the potential was there and we hoped it was going to rain. I'm kind of a positive guy, like, glass half full, and it rained. And we got some of the best yields we ever had. And you can see, you know, throughout the year what's going on, how it's trending to the long-term average. It's really, I don't want to say it's simple, but it is quite simple, just taking a bit of intelligence and displaying it in a way where you can make a decision very quickly. And now we can look at, hey, what did it look like at the end of the year? This is my soil moisture profile going into winter. Maybe next year is going to be pretty good. And we can see based on, hey, if I only have 50% of rainfall next year, I still can grow 50 bushels of canola based on water. I've got to do some other things, right, to get there, but that's not so bad, right? Another thing that I think is kind of cool, and we'll see how it all goes, is Soil Reader. I went to AgriTechnic with them, and so they have a system where they're putting spectral into the soil and can read nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, EC, about nine different things in real time. And just the amount of data that we're gonna get off of that is pretty mind-blowing. So there's more work to do with this and lots to learn, but there's gonna be new technologies that come along that just really change the way that we do things. And so this is kind of how I look at precision agriculture in my mind, is really it's doing things better than we did yesterday to help grow a bigger and brighter future for the generations to come. That's what I'm passionate about. And for me, we don't have to get it right. We just have to do it better than we did it yesterday. And I love this quote from Rob. I just read this in the book the other day, but this is really what it comes down to the basis of what you should be thinking about with precision programs. Poor agronomy plus precision agriculture equals poor agronomy precisely applied. I love that quote, and it's very, very true. And so this is what I think about, and what I've been thinking about more lately, is how do we put this all together? And so I think about the convergence of new technology plus agri-food intelligence plus agronomy backed by science plus a sustainable benefit to the grower and the consumer, in my mind, equals growing our future. That's where I want to go and what we want to do. Something I'm really passionate about. So I think, you know, with that, just some tools and mindset to help prepare yourself for the future is, you know, if you do what you've always done, you'll get what you'll always got. And I don't think many of us are going to be here in 10 years if we are going to just be happy with getting what we always got. You've got to embrace change. And most people aren't excited about change, but the reality is change is good. It's hard sometimes, and we screw it up. But the world is changing, and it's changing more rapidly every day, and it's not going to slow down. So you better figure out how to have some fun with it. The best way to predict your future is to create it. We all have the ability here in this room to help mold the future that we're going to have. And it could be terrible, like you see everywhere in social media and the news, or it could be pretty amazing. And there's amazing things going on all over the place. Bill Gates is doing amazing things. If you watch, you know, his Netflix show there, it's pretty cool. A good plan today is better than a perfect plan tomorrow. So this is such a stumbling block for so many of us in the industry. So we can't do that because it's not perfect yet. Well, we'll never be able to do anything because we're never going to get it all perfect. Just if it's better, yeah, it sucks that we have 120-foot boom sprayers and we can't do the granularity that we want to, but is it better than doing flat rate across the whole field? Like if we get 60% of it right instead of none of it right before, is that better? You know, just worry about making it better, even if it's a little bit. I like really been focusing on the 80-20 rule. What's the first 20% that you can do to get 80% of the value? Just do that. And then worry about, you know, the fine tuning and the tweaking on top. Don't miss out on the 80% because you're waiting for it to be perfect. Have an abundance mindset. I think this is something that has been coming up more and more in my travels in agriculture. I went to Ukraine last winter. And the largest farm in Ukraine, 1.2 million acres, puts on a conference like Farm Forum where they invite in all their partners and they share all the stuff that they're doing. What farm in Canada would do that? Right? And their mindset is, you know what, if we share our knowledge, we'll learn from each other and we're going to lift the whole industry and move forward together. Isn't that a great thing? Shouldn't we be thinking more about those kind of things? And I just seen this when I was in Germany, I really liked it. It's a Dutch proverb, if you can't prevent the wind, you can't prevent the wind, but you can build a windmill, right? So we can't stop all this stuff from happening, but we can build tools to leverage it and do some cool stuff. So with that, you know, Dan, my brother Dan, I gotta thank him for helping get the Grow in the Future podcast going, and it's kind of a cool thing where we talk about fun stuff that's interesting to us, maybe not be interesting to anybody else, but check it out. Maybe it'll be interesting for you. And I guess, you know, this is kind of how we look at things and with the things that we do. You know, we just don't want to feed the world. We want to help change it and be part of that. It's exciting. And this is kind of what I feel. It's our job to help create a future that's bigger than our past. And, you know, having the opportunity to travel around a bit and see some of those that don't have as much as we have here and the abundance that we have, I think this other quote is something that really resonates with me in the test of your progress. It's not whether we add more to the abundance who those have much, but it's whether we can provide enough for those who have too little. So hopefully I left some time for a few questions or something like that. You know, Dan took up most of my time at the beginning, so I kind of had to rush through.
You know how it is. You're the little brother.
That's right.
Is there any questions for Terry?
Just something to add yet, too. I mean, a lot of the people that have helped me and inspired me and coached me along the way are in this room, and I'd like to thank them for the journey. And something that I really love about agriculture is it's always changing and evolving, and if you're getting bored in agriculture, you're really doing something wrong, I think. But anyways, it's been a pretty amazing journey over the past 10, 12 years, and pretty excited about what the next...
Are you going to let somebody ask a question?
Yeah, I will. I didn't see anybody babble putting on their hands up, so...
Okay, somebody ask a question, so we, you know... I guess then Terry will talk more, will be the net result, yeah. But...
That's why they're not putting their hand up.
Anybody want to keep Terry talking? You got all that, like AI and biologicals and spectrometers and VR and putting things in grass and... Yeah.
So Terry, where was your yield goals, say canola 10 years ago, where are they now? Where are they going to be 5 years?
Yeah, great question. So 10 years ago, I mean, probably we were shooting for 40 bushels. Now we're shooting for 65 or 70. 10 years from now, we should be 75, maybe. I don't know. I mean, we're not always getting those yields yet, but one thing that we have experienced in our farm, and I think it's a bit of accumulation of, well, either we're just really lucky, or accumulation of everything that we've been doing. We've broke our canola yield record on the whole farm 3 years in a row. And I mean, we had a good year in our area this last year, but not, most guys hadn't beat their yield, you know, canola yield record until this year from like, you know, whatever it was, 7, 8 years ago or whatever the year was, I can't remember. I'm not good at dates, but yeah, we're consistently seeing better and better results all the time and more consistent results. And I think it's just accumulation of all the little things, all the little 5%.
Can I add something, Terry?
Yes, please.
And it's related to Rob's question. Great question. What we've learned within Crop Intelligence is that those growers that are shooting for a higher yield, and some of you are in the session this morning, the number for canola per inch of crop available water after the factory on average is 5.7. Terry's number is probably 6.3, simply because he's shooting for higher yields, which means he's got more of the details in place. And so what does that mean in terms of where our crop yields are going to get into the future? For guys like Terry and the rest of you in the room that are tweaking the systems on a constant basis, it means that on a water-driven yield potential basis, I would say 75% of Western Canada can tickle 100 bushels per acre. And I know that because we actually ran the math a few years ago when some crazy man put out a 100 bushel yield contest. Might be sitting in the room. But yeah, so his number is 6.3. The average is 5.7, and some guys are even doing greater. So
one of the biggest challenges we have in ag right now is the size of our equipment. We have this huge equipment, and we've all gotten excited about bigger tractors and more horsepower and, like, you know, what's the tool shed guy, whatever his name is there, you know, like, oh. But, and we've done that because of maybe lack of labor, whatever it may be, but I keep thinking about all the variability in the field and what you could do better in those areas of salinity or whatever it may be, but it's hard to manage because we want big open fields and 100-foot drills and pulling a grain bin behind us and all this stuff. But we are quickly going to shift to different tools and ability with autonomous tractors and small things. And what if we could have a field, your half section or whatever your section field, this big, huge, amazing field that actually has 4 or 5 different crops in it now, because we have the ability to plant grass or whatever the crop is in this area that has the best output in that piece of land. And we're only growing canola in the spots that, you know, that will greatly accelerate our yields and potential, and we will very quickly have the ability to do that. We just got to figure out how to put it all together. And so there's going to be some huge opportunities when we get away from that. Yeah, so it's a challenge. Like, actually, we've been doing DST trials with Bayer and LBSF for 10 years, and we only have like about 3 or 4 fields on our farm where we actually can find a block to put that in, and that, you know, is good. And so first off, usually when we look to set up a trial, we look at all of our maps and our yield maps and where the water is going and all that stuff, and try to pick an area of the field where it's basically in one zone or all the same. And set the trial up there. But when you're doing like broad acre stuff, it is probably the simplest to apply flat treatments or rates or whatever across all the zones and then just measure the response. But there's also kind of come to light, it's incredibly frustrating that in today's world of technology, our yield monitors are all basically still crap. Like, I hate to say it, but it's absolutely true. And a lot of guys like Ag Truth Research, if you go look, like, they've proven it, right? So what we're doing now is we're setting up these trials like on the full field scale when we go to seed or spray, and then we're looking at the data throughout the year. We're looking at the zone, we're looking at images throughout the year and all these things, and then we basically pick a small plot or various small plots within the whole field where we think we can get the best data, and then we're going and cutting around them and using a weigh scale wagon. And it's actually working incredibly well. Still kind of learning how to tweak that system, but it's a challenge. So I totally didn't answer your question there. I just added probably a whole bunch of other questions. But yeah, you really got to pay attention to what you're doing. And if you're just splitting fields or doing whole strips, I got a presentation we did a couple years ago where we showed just individual strips across the whole field, like it was a variety trial, and there was all kinds of variants, and it was the same crop, same field, same treatment. And just every strip is different based on what amount of soil type or zone you took into that strip.
Terry, my question to you is, looking to the future, you've done a lot of travel, you've been to a lot of places. Canola was a game changer in the 70s, pulses were a game changer in the 90s. What's the new game changer for crop fly?
Lots of whiskey. No, I don't know. That's a really good question. I think it kind of goes back to what I alluded to earlier. I think we're going to very quickly have the ability to do various things within a field. And that's going to be really hard to deprogram, because everyone wants to like drive 2 miles straight and watch Netflix while they're seeding or whatever. Not that anybody actually does that, but yeah, I think we're going to look at, instead of trying to do one thing across the whole field, you know, maybe it's various different varieties and intercrops, and you know, so I think it's not going to be, I don't see one. Well, it's hemp. Hemp is a magical crop in CBD that everyone's thinking going to save the world, but I don't think that's quite going to happen either. But
I know it's shocking, but I actually have to cut Terry off.
Thank you.
Sorry. Big round of applause for Terry. He did an awesome job. Hopefully that has value.
Thanks for listening to the Growing the Future podcast. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for highlights of the show. Also, full-length videos of the show are available on our website, www.growingthefuturepodcast.ca, and on YouTube. We would very much appreciate if you took the time to visit our sponsor, Eberhardt Ag Solutions, at eberhardtagsolutions.ca, where you can find innovative solutions that transform your farm.